If you'd like to receive this podcast early and without ads, consider becoming a member of the DSR Network. Listeners to this show can receive 25% off the membership price. In addition to an ad-free listening experience and early access, members receive bonus content for virtually all of our shows via our private member feed, enhanced show notes for selected podcasts, and an invitation to join the DSR Slack community. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and enter code NOJOKE to receive 25% off. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code NOJOKE. This offer is limited and will expire on Saturday, April 6th, so act now. And thank you very much for your support.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm David Rothkopf, one of your co-hosts, along with Chris Kottmeyer. How are you doing, Chris?
Doing well, thank you.
Excellent. And Riley Fessler. How are you this morning, Riley?
Not too bad.
This is the DSR Daily. We look at what's going on in the world, try to make a little sense of it. Where do you want to start, Riley?
Well, No Labels has officially announced that they have failed to find a candidate
too bad.
To run in the 2024 presidential election. I know you're devastated, David.
Those jerks are unsuccessful. Too bad. Good for America. Bad for those losers.
Yeah, they raised $60 million for the campaign, which, of course, as we all know, aimed to offer an alternative to major party nominees, which hopes pinned on a, quote, bipartisan approach. They were rejected by everybody they tried to court, including Joe Manchin, Larry Hogan, Nikki Haley, Chris Christie, David Petraeus, and even more. So nobody was buying this, at least candidate-wise.
Bill Maher wasn't available?
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, just a total disaster. A waste of $60 million, but thankfully they're not going to actually run anybody.
Yeah, well, you know, as we say in Yiddish, Zeigesund. In other words, you know, go in good health. Nice to see you disappear from the scene. You won't be missed. Chris?
Maybe you should run.
It's an interesting idea. We can build up the base of this podcast to like 70 million people. I will run.
Excellent. Israel plans to increase humanitarian aid to Gaza, including reopening a northern border crossing, following pressure from U.S. President Joe Biden to enhance civilian and aid worker protection amidst the ongoing conflict with Hamas. Benjamin Netanyahu and Biden spoke yesterday. Would have loved to have been a fly on the wall there in terms of the conversation that must have taken place. But in any case, this is certainly a positive development. And I want to see, let me take a step back. I was thinking this morning, Hamas, of course, attacked Israel on October 7th. And, you know, there's responsibility for, you know, in terms of the civilian casualties to some extent. But the way that Israel has carried out their attacks, and including the most recent egregious attack on humanitarian aid workers, we have got to take a stronger stance. This seems like a move in that direction. I'm interested in what you think about that, David, but this seems like a positive development to me.
Well, look, opening aid access points to Gaza is a positive development. I can take perhaps three things away from this. One, Israel was blocking aid to Gaza. Otherwise, they would have opened these before. Two, leverage works and raises the question of what would more leverage earlier have done? In other words, Biden said, do this or else. And they believed him. They believed him in part because the reaction of the World Central Kitchen attack was so great. But nonetheless, it shows leverage works. And three, it's not going to address all the issues. And that means we need to apply more leverage. And that means, some kind of material action. My own view on this, and I expressed this in a column which appeared late last night on the Daily Beast and is up today, is that the United States should right now suspend offensive military aid to Israel and say, look, you wanted the military aid back? That's fine, but we're not going to provide it and be complicit in war crimes in Gaza. When aid is surged into Gaza, when there is a ceasefire, when accept a roadmap to a two-state solution, then we'll provide the aid. We want Israel to be strong and to be able to defend itself against attacks from like the likes of Iran and the region. But we made a mistake. We gave Bibi Netanyahu too much power over U.S. foreign policy. By giving him carte blanche and all the weapons he needed, not only was he able to do these bad things, but every time he did it, the message to the world was he was doing it with the U.S. And, yes, Hamas started this war. Yes, Hamas should be gone. Yes, the hostages should be released. But none of that justifies 33,000 dead, 70,000 injured, 2 million people at risk of famine, 1 million people at high risk of famine, 200 aid workers dead, 200 journalists dead. None of it justifies that. And so we've got to say, we're not supporting it. When you get back on the right track, we will be ready to talk. Riley?
Well, the U.S. Justice Department's case against Chinese tech giant Huawei, which involves allegations of misleading banks about its operations in Iran, as well as other charges, is set to go to trial in January 2026. So the announcement came after settlement discussions reached an impasse, as reported during a status conference in Brooklyn. The case stems from a 2018 indictment. And has significantly impacted U.S.-China relations, as you can imagine, given Huawei's massive status in China. The broader allegations include bank fraud and conspiring to steal trade secrets from U.S. technology firms, and those remain unresolved, as Huawei has pled not guilty. So the trial is expected to last 4 to 6 months, but I'm just stunned that this has taken so long. I guess it's just, because of the magnitude of the case. But I'm curious your thoughts, David, on why this has taken so long and, what effects you expect it to have on China-U.S. relations.
Well, I don't know the legal technicalities behind the case. We've seen in the Trump cases and others that well-funded parties, cases like this, have many means for delaying tactics. The United States targeted Huawei for some reasons that were legitimate and other reasons that had to do with the political mood between the United States and Huawei. I think some of the things that Huawei has been accused of here, they've certainly done. And my guess is because conducting a trial like this could have such big negative ramifications there isn't a trial in the long run, that there is some kind of a settlement, some kind of agreement to set this aside. And I think that's what's being teed up. Could be wrong, but that's what my guess is. Chris?
Rescue efforts in Taiwan intensified following the 7.4 magnitude earthquake that hit yesterday, causing landslides and isolating hundreds in Taroko Gorge National Park. The death toll has reached 12. 13 people are missing, including foreign nationals. But the good news is that rescue workers are having some success rescuing trapped individuals, and aid is flowing into Taiwan from countries, including Japan, which I'm happy to see that the response has been swift. It's also worth noting that Taiwan was, I guess, as prepared as a country could be in terms of earthquakes. They obviously get a lot of them. The damage could have been far worse. And, again, a good response to a natural disaster, which, of course, they have no control over.
Yeah, you see that a lot in that part of Asia on the sort of ring of fire, where they're so-called ring of fire, where you get a lot of earthquakes, also volcanic activity, and big and countries that are advanced and have significant financial resources develop the building codes that enable buildings to withstand these things, develop the response capabilities, the rapid response capabilities that enable you to reduce death tolls, develop, you know, barriers and other kinds of ways to avoid tsunami damage, early alert systems, and so forth. We see this, for example, in Japan. The problem is that in poorer countries, they can't do that. And so very often, you know, a big earthquake or in a place like Haiti, you know, can be catastrophic in its effect. And certainly one thing we have to have as a goal is to bring as much as possible the current state of knowledge and technology to bear to protect less developed countries and to avoid large loss of life as this example indicates as possible. Riley?
Well, the EPA has announced a $20 billion allocation in federal green bank grants to 8 community development banks and nonprofit organizations, of course, aimed at combating climate change in disadvantaged communities. So the program and this new wave of funding was actually announced by Vice President Kamala Harris in a trip to Charlotte. The grants are part of the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, which was established by the Inflation Reduction Act, and is financing a broad range of projects from energy efficient home improvements to electrical vehicle charging stations. And kind of one of the main aspects of this is that it empowers communities to kind of choose projects that best serve their specific needs rather than imposing projects on them. So great program, of course, unsurprisingly, is facing opposition from congressional Republicans who are trying to strike it down, but hopefully it continues and gives out more funding.
Well, you know, it's been passed and it's being implemented. It's kind of a pity that the Inflation Reduction Act, which was named that in order to get the political support it needed, isn't known by, you know, another possible name that could be applied to it, which is the largest green investment program in American history, which directs $300 billion plus towards green energy and combating climate change. It's the biggest initiative we've ever undertaken in that regard. It's important not just in combating climate change. It's also important in developing these technologies here in the U.S., that make us competitive. It has long-term benefits, including reducing the costs that are associated with things like, you know, acid rain, climate deterioration, and so forth. So, you know, this is a big, huge initiative of enormous benefit that, you know, the administration may not be getting as much credit as it deserves for. But it's good you highlight it, and it's the kind of thing we should track right here, which we will do each and every episode of this podcast, which occurs every day. And we've got other podcasts. We've got the Daily Blast with the New Republic that occurs every day. What's coming up on that one, Riley?
Greg actually sits down with Jamie Raskin.
Yeah, Jamie Raskin's a great guy, real hero. In my last book, he was kind of the hero of the defenders of democracy in this country. Well worth listening to. We did a good podcast yesterday with our friend Allison Gill of the Mueller She Wrote podcast group, and we talked about legal issues, as we sometimes do. We covered every single Trump case, and within 1 minute of releasing the podcast, Judge Cannon produced this bizarre ruling in which she said, yes, we will not set aside this case on the basis of Trump's completely ridiculous Presidential Records Act defense. But we may come back to it during the trial. And of course, that's the, you know, the really important thing to zero in on, because coming back to it during the trial, after a jury is seated, would mean that double jeopardy has attached to the trial. And if she just threw it out, then this case is gone. And so there's a lot of speculation that what will happen is that Jack Smith will respond saying, no, you've got to make your decision on this known before the trial. That's via something called an in limine filing. And that if she does not do it and does not do it in a timely way, then he would have the opportunity to get rid of mandamus, go to the 11th Circuit, and have her decision corrected on this, and possibly have her removed from the case. So while it looked like there was a win there for Jack Smith, that's not actually what happened yesterday. I wish we could have talked to Allison about it, but we just talked about it here. So consider this a little additional bit that attaches to that. And that's why you should listen to every single one of our podcasts. Yes, it would take you 17 hours a week. But what else are you doing in your time? Say you work out and you listen to our podcast. That's 17 hours of working out a week. Think of how fit you would be. It's getting to be springtime. You want to get into bathing suit condition. I guarantee you, if you listen to 17 hours of DSR podcasts a week while you are working out, you are going to look better than you have ever looked at the gym. You don't need Ozempic. You'll save all the money that you would save on those fancy drugs, and you'll be healthier, and you'll live longer. That's the DSR fitness program as developed by Chris Cottmore. And it can be yours for the small price of listening to all of our podcasts and being a member. So that's a good way to end the week. It's Friday. Have a good weekend, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye. We'll be right back.